Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. On today's episode, we have my interview with Alex Edelman, whose one-man Broadway show, Just For Us, premiered as a special on HBO this past weekend and is streaming now on Max. But first, my Daily Beast colleague Allegra is back, and we are ready to dive into the Curb Your Enthusiasm series finale. Allegra, welcome back.
Hello. Happy to be back to talk about a historic moment in television.
It really was. And I think we have to start with the fact that you really nailed your prediction last week about how this would play out, because you noticed a bunch of references to the Seinfeld finale throughout this final season. And that really paid off in this final episode.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it feels a little obvious to me that he was going to just, you know, reference one of his biggest finales ever. I mean, one of the biggest finales ever and one of the biggest things Larry David has ever done. But it was kind of fun to see how he threaded that in with just sort of the subtle references. But the last episode really went so hard on it. It was kind of just a redo in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously on his mind, I guess, as he was thinking about how to end a show and the previous time he ended a show and how that went and how it was received. And so, yeah, it was definitely interesting to see him very much double down on it. It's sort of the way that everyone's been talking about it, but also kind of try to fix it. And I think we'll get to that final scene in a minute. But, you know, just in terms of the episode overall, it was an extra long one, which was, I guess, should have been expected. And I thought it was just packed with like lots of little, obviously cameos and guest stars and pretty big name cameos like Greg Kinnear and Allison Janney, and then a lot of other little people popping up, including Jerry Seinfeld, of course. But then just like so many, I feel like he was like trying to work in all of the like little ideas and jokes that he hadn't gotten in yet before it was too late. So I don't know, for you, was there a moment or sort of even one of those smaller moments from earlier in the episode before we got to that major Seinfeld finale part that stood out for you?
Yeah, I mean, in general, I thought it was so funny how Larry was kind of blasé about all of it. Like, he got more worked up about Richard Lewis's girlfriend for a while, which the like Allison Janney cameo that was so chill. Like, I love that he was just, you know, so shocked and incredulous that Richard Lewis would have a girlfriend that would threaten to kill herself over him. Yeah. And then trying to suss that out, which was like such a classic but very short subplot that ended up, like, to me, paying off pretty well. Like, you know, when he calls out her bluff on that one. And then Richard Lewis mentions it again at court where he says, you know, she bought a gun to kill you.
Yeah, of course, my head went to, is this going to end with Allison Janney murdering David as he's like being walked to the jail cell? That's really, I thought that's where they were going for a minute. And I was like, that would be an interesting way to end.
Yeah, it's just like such a kind of random little plot, especially with a high profile cameo. And then to thread it back in at the end was just so funny to me. So making sure that there were still his other classic annoyances and social not niceties was really good. I'm glad it wasn't solely just hyper-focused on the trial, just because also Larry wasn't. Like, he just clearly was like,
Yeah, he was distracted so much along the way. Yeah, I was glad that Richard Lewis was there. I got a little worried at the beginning because they were like, he's not on the plane and he's going to meet us there. And I was like, oh no, are they going to do some like Richard Lewis died in the show plotline, which they've always resisted doing. You know, I thought they were going to do that a while back with Bob Einstein, who played Marty Funkhauser, and they really kind of resisted the urge to do that as well. Kind of these guest stars or these, you know, supporting players who have died during this long run of the show. They've never really given them the tribute in that way, but they did. He did have a great, I mean, Richard Lewis had a great storyline in this final episode, which was nice to see.
Yeah. I feel like Larry David really does care so much about his friends and especially Richard Lewis that even though he comes off as such a dick in the show, like he would never do something, not that that would be dickish, but I think he just really wants to like honor his friends and his relationships. And I think it was hard for him to even talk about Bob Einstein dying, like in that Bob Einstein Super Dave doc, if you've ever seen that. He was just clearly like, oh, he was amazing. It was the best, like, you know, I think he honors them both by just having them in there and letting their memories stand. So it was definitely nice to see Richard Lewis back. I was happy that, you know, Leon came too. Of course he was going to,
yeah,
but it was just like the classic crew, Leon and Jeff and Susie. And Susie and Jeff had a pretty good plot too, although I was so annoyed about it. When
the salad dressing,
I was screaming at my TV when Jeff was calling Auntie Mama Ray or whatever to get that dressing,
because
I was like, this is not gonna go well. I was so mad. I was like, come on, Larry, do not participate in this. You are going to be, you know, you're going to be found guilty. The jury hates you.
That was one of the more hammy moments, I think, in the show's history, too, that phone call.
Yeah. Where he's pretending to be this guy's dying wife. It was painful. It was funny, but it was just so painful to watch.
Yeah, that was a good example of like how the show has escalated over the years in terms of like, it was a little more subtle at the beginning in the same way that Seinfeld was more subtle in the beginning than it was towards the end.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. He really leaned into his cartoon sensibilities by the end for both shows.
Well, Leon binging Seinfeld and that being a runner throughout the episode, I thought was so funny, and obviously was sort of nodding towards the parallels as well. But just the idea of Leon during this like few day trip to Atlanta, watching all of Seinfeld, whenever we're not seeing him, was so funny, and his running commentary on it.
I watched a few Seinfeld episodes on the plane and shit. You never told me it was a show about weekly ass.
It's not a show about weekly ass.
Jerry just constantly got ass every week. Though I thought it was in the beginning, I said, this ain't a fucking TV show. This is more of a fuck documentary. That's what it felt like. Yeah, man.
And then, you know, leading up to that incredible scene in the courtroom with him and Jerry Seinfeld, who, you know, I don't think they've interacted all that much over the years on this show. But that was a special one for sure.
I mean, I remember that episode, I think the season when they did the Seinfeld reunion, when Leon and Seinfeld and Jerry had like a pretty prolonged conversation. I remember they had a really good rapport in one of their episodes. So it was nice to see them back again. And I love that Leon just managed to watch 9 seasons of Seinfeld in like, what, 4 days or something, however long they were there.
That's so good. Yeah. I mean, so then I think we should talk about the Seinfeld parallels and the ending. You know, I was sort of thinking, looking back at the Seinfeld finale and thinking about how they were the same and how they were different. And what really stood out to me is on Seinfeld in the finale, if people remember, the 4 main characters, they're on trial for violating this random Good Samaritan law where they didn't help someone who was in trouble. And they sort of just laughed at him instead. And it's really this like the height of their cruelty is this crime that they commit. And then, of course, the trial then looks back at all the other heinous things they did over the years. But the thing that they're on trial for is actually really bad. Whereas with Larry, he's arrested for something that's like genuinely noble, which is giving this older woman water in line as she's waiting to vote. So I don't know what that says or maybe about how Larry David has changed, but I think the fact that he gave his character that, at least that level of redemption where he's not actually on trial for something bad, he's on trial for something that like everyone can agree was the right thing to do, was just an interesting wrinkle.
Yeah, it's so funny to, you know, he always says that he's the butt of the joke and that we're never supposed to sympathize with him or anybody. But this was the rare time where, you know, we really want Larry to be validated, to be vindicated as the good guy here. Like, I was so frustrated to find that he was clearly losing this case, because we like him ultimately. We're rooting for him. So it's interesting that they set it up that way where we kind of, I think we have to, or maybe I felt like I had to because this law is so stupid. But it did speak to how he was sort of trying to subvert the original finale, the Seinfeld finale, in a lot of ways, and especially with the ending. Like, even just from the top, it's the irony of this horrible person being proven to be a good guy, or at least in the public opinion, which is so unexpected. But then we sort of expect it to still go the same way that the Seinfeld finale does, and then it does to an extent until it doesn't.
So we should, talking about that, I mean, there's sort of this fake out ending that really is exactly like the Seinfeld ending, where Larry's alone in the jail cell and he's looking at his pants tent, which is from the very first episode of Curb, the same way that at the Seinfeld finale they're talking about the buttons on the shirt, which is the first conversation that Jerry and George have on the very first episode of Seinfeld. So it's this kind of full circle moment again, and you think, oh, he's going to end it exactly the same way. And then in comes walking Jerry Seinfeld to save the day and change things and get him off with this, you know, very funny technicality that calls back to a scene earlier in the episode, which I had sort of forgotten about by that point because it had no connection to anything else. This guy who he thinks looks like Joe Pesci. So did you see that coming, or were you as surprised as I was?
I was definitely a bit surprised by how it cleared up. I kind of was hoping, I was like, surely this can't just be a repeat. Like, I would be kind of disappointed. So I was,
yeah, kind if it was of, just like,
you know, like shot the Seinfeld shot thing. Yeah. So I assumed something was going to happen. I didn't necessarily expect that it was going to be Jerry bailing him out in that way. But when I was watching it, that scene with the Pesci guy, I was talking with the person I watched it with, and we really were like, this is such an important scene in general because it shows how so much of the show could be avoided if Larry just would say no. Like, Seinfeld, yes. Jerry
the
was
so...
The
way he handles that situation.
Right. Like, because, what's his name? Charlton Copley shows up again as that South African, the businessman that brought Larry there. And if Larry had only just said no, because clearly he didn't want to do the thing, he didn't want to be cordial at a party. And then when this guy sees Jerry and is like, oh, would you just have to be cordial, you just have to take a photo. And Jerry's like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that, and I'm not going to.
That really sums up the difference between the two of them, right?
Yeah. So we were like, okay, literally, no, he's not going to do it. And if only Larry had said that exact same thing, this would never have happened.
That's great, yeah.
So we were thinking a lot about that moment and just how it really speaks to the two of them. And then the Pesci thing, I was just like, oh, this is classic Jerry just being a goof.
That was the key to the whole episode.
He's not supposed to be in a Mexican restaurant because he's under sequester.
He broke a sequester?
Broke a sequester.
He's supposed to sequester.
He's supposed to sequester.
He's supposed to sequester.
You can't not sequester when he's supposed to sequester.
You should be sequestering.
Yeah.
So then obviously he, you know, they get to walk out of jail and he has this, you know, moment of there's a mistrial and it doesn't end like Seinfeld. And then we finally get what we've been kind of waiting for, is for them to acknowledge the parallels with Jerry saying, oh, this is how we should have ended the show. And it did make me think, like, so the implication is that they kind of fixed the Seinfeld finale. But I was wondering, like, is that why people were mad about the Seinfeld finale, that they all ended up in prison, or was it something else? Like, why do you think the Seinfeld finale was so divisive, and did this actually, you know, fix that problem?
Yeah. I mean, obviously I was not around for the contemporaneous. I don't know if you were really paying attention either when it aired.
I have to say I was watching it week to week at that point.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I was not because it was, I believe I was in preschool when that aired.
Yeah, yeah, okay, okay.
But so I wasn't. But in my reading of it since, I do feel like a lot of people felt like that was a cop-out. Because even though, again, we are sort of expected to dislike these people, I don't. You know, I love all of the people on Seinfeld. I've spent so long watching them. You know, I'd spent 9 seasons watching them. Like, I can fully understand being frustrated that they are, you know, reprimanded in this kind of way. Also because it does feel so over the top. I think a big complaint about the post-Larry David parts of Seinfeld, which is interesting that he then wrote this, was that it became really unrealistic. Like, a lot of people have pointed to that Merv Griffin show episode where Kramer has a whole talk show set. Like, they're like, this is really...
You know, they're doing things like doing it. They did an episode very towards the end where the whole thing was told backwards, where each scene was like the scene before, which is one of the weirdest episodes, which, like, yeah, they obviously never would have done that early on. And I'm not sure Larry would have co-signed that.
Yeah. So to do something that does feel extremely improbable, these guys all going to jail. I can see that being just frustrating to people. Where this, what we like about the show is that it's so mundane and very relatable, and the really nitpicky complaints that people have. And then for it to go completely in a different direction where it's like, of course, this would never happen. This would never happen. Well, and maybe they don't deserve that.
You could say that about this. I mean, that Larry spending a year in prison for this crime would never happen to a man with as much privilege as he has. So
maybe
like, that was a comment as well.
Yeah, he can just pay off. He can give them like $3 million that like it's nothing and then call it a day. So that's always been my read on the Seinfeld finale, that it just felt like this came out of nowhere and was not necessary.
Yeah, too ridiculous.
Yeah, too ridiculous. So this whole prison jail, this whole plot line for Larry was also kind of ridiculous, but I think one, they threaded it through the whole season, so it wasn't just out of nowhere like with the Seinfeld finale, and it wasn't ever on his mind. Like Larry was so concerned with everything else. This was not a big deal to him.
He cared more about the name of his lawyer's baby than he did about the trial.
Yeah. Did we even learn what was his lawyer in this final episode's name? Like, she was such a strange character to me.
Yeah. I don't know. She kind of came out of nowhere, but yeah, she took over for Sean Hayes. But yeah, so, I mean, now, you know, he is once again confirmed in interviews and everything that this is the end of the show and that he will not be coming back as he has done before. It did make me think, you know, will we ever see him do anything in public again? You know, I was thinking about David Letterman, who retired from The Late Show, and it was kind of like, you could have imagined him really disappearing to nowhere, but then in a couple of years, he was back with this Netflix show and interviewing people again. And I just wonder whether Larry will be able to stay away. But at the same time, like, I have no concept of what he would do if he wasn't playing this version of Larry David that has been in our lives for 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't really, there's a slight period, I feel like he, well, maybe not. I think it was literally just the Woody Allen movie. I was saying that, like, when he pursued acting.
He had a movie career.
Yeah, really didn't. That really didn't happen.
I think that's better for us all to forget about that one in particular.
Yeah. So I went to this event on Friday before the finale, hosted by HBO, where it was like it wasn't a talk back because this was before the finale aired and they didn't show anything from it. But Larry was there and they didn't explicitly ask him that question of what do you want to do next? But they asked him, do you think you'll come back and do more? And he's like, I'm 76 years old. And I think that honestly says a lot. Like, no, he wants to be done. He wants to be retired. He's old. He doesn't want to do any of this anymore. So I don't necessarily think he's done for good, but I don't think he really wants to be in front of the camera or completely in charge of anything anymore from what it sounds like. I think he's just, it's been 24 years of being in charge of a thing. I think he's fully done with that.
If we never see him again, but happy for him if he has a nice life.
I'm sure it seems like everybody wants his commentary on every single thing. So I'm sure they'll be calling him up to get sound bites on like MSNBC.
A CNN talking head. Yeah, that'll be
exactly. That'd be a funny third act.
Yeah. Okay. So next week on this podcast, you'll be back with me. And I thought maybe we could do a little preview of Conan O'Brien Must Go, which is a show that Conan is finally back after so much teasing and talk about coming back after his talk show ended. There's finally this 4-episode travel show on Max that I've gotten to see a couple episodes of so far and have really been enjoying. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about that. And then I thought maybe we could also do a little bit of SNL talk because you and I are both kind of SNL obsessives. And next weekend is Ryan Gosling, which I feel like has some good potential.
Yeah, I feel like they're really excited because he was on this week's
SNL. I
know,
he's already there hanging out.
Yeah, he's there so early. He's prepping.
So it better be a good show. All right. So for this episode, I talked to Alex Edelman, who is a comedian who I really didn't know too much about until I started hearing insane amount of buzz around his one-man show, Just for Us, when it was running off-Broadway in New York. And then it moved to Broadway and then it went on tour. I got to see it out here in California. So I was just really excited to talk to him about it. Since he and I did not really like break down the story of the show, I thought maybe I could do a quick little share what the premise of it is for anyone who doesn't know or hasn't seen it yet. Alex grew up as an Orthodox Jew in the Boston area, which is where I'm from. And one day he decided to see what would happen if he just kind of showed up at a meeting he heard about on Twitter of white supremacists in Queens. He kind of goes to this neo-Nazi meeting, infiltrates it in a way, the show really uses that real story in his life as a narrative to talk about big ideas like anti-Semitism and assimilation and what it means to be white in America. So yeah, I know it sounds very hilarious, but it actually is a really, really funny show and super thought-provoking. And it just premiered on Max over the weekend. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to check it out yet, Allegra, but I highly recommend it to anyone listening if you haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things. I saw people talking about it on Twitter and they showed it a clip of it before every single thing I watched on HBO this week.
Yes, yes. Oh, perfect. Yeah. Definitely everybody check that out if you haven't already. And before we get into my conversation with Alex, here's a clip from Just For Us in which he reveals the random tweet that ended up forever altering his comedy career.
And the tweet says, "Hey! If you live in NYC and you have questions about your whiteness, come to 441 27th Avenue, which is in Queens, tomorrow night at 9:15. And I saw the tweet and I thought to myself, I live in NYC. And as an Ashkenazi Jew, I have some questions about my whiteness.
Alex, so great to have you here. And I feel like I'm getting you in the middle of what must be an incredibly surreal week. We're talking just before the special version of Just For Us is coming out on HBO, but you were on The Tonight Show last night. I think you were also on The View yesterday, having this very emotional moment with Whoopi Goldberg. How are you feeling?
I mean, like a bucket of bees, buddy. You know, Matt, I feel crazy every day, but also this is what you want for your work, right? Like this is what a comedian wants for his work, to get to have an emotional moment with Whoopi Goldberg in front of Joy Behar.
Yeah.
That's every comedian. I remember when I was a kid, I just thought, God, if I could have an emotional moment in front of Joy Behar, my life would really be complete. But no, look, not to give you a serious answer, but it's very cool. Like, I never done The Tonight Show before, and I got to see this, like, utility closet that's decorated, that, like, the creative team behind The Muppets was waiting to film The Tonight Show, like, 40, 50 years ago, and they found a utility closet full of pipes, and they decorated the pipes. And so there's, like, a Muppets pipe closet.
Wow.
And
The
Tonight Show, and I didn't know that, so I got to be close to that. I mean, it was really cool, and Fallon's like actually tremendous. Like it was really, he's a great comic, great comedy mind. So like it's really cool, man. I'm like really, I'm very verklempt. And as for the special, like it's nice. People seem to be really responding to it so far. So yeah, here's hoping.
Yeah. I mean, so far, obviously it's just people who've kind of seen it in advance. And then the world will see it, tomorrow as we're talking, but it will already be out when people are hearing this. The filmed version of Just For Us feels like the end step of this very long process that you've been on. So how are you feeling about that? How are you feeling about this show that you've been working on for so long, like actually being over now?
I have so many different, I feel like literally any emotion you pitched at me, I could tell you how like a dimension of like, if you were like joyful, I'd be like, well, I got to do this the right way. You know, I got to like work it in a way that's so thorough with so many layers that I'm really proud of the work. And I don't think I could have done better. And it's gotten to went to Broadway. Like how many solo shows get a chance to go up on Broadway? And, you know, I got to do it in front of so many, hundreds of thousands of people and like, not at once, that'd be crazy. But like, and I got to tour it around the world, and I got to lay it down as a special in its most sort of salubrious form on Broadway. So that's really joyous. And also, it's been a lot of fun, but I'm also sad. You know, it's my last work I ever get to do with my director, Adam Brace. And Adam and I had a really fruitful creative partnership. And so that's a bummer that my last, you know, connection to my friend is kind of, going to be cut off in this way. And also.
Yeah. Yeah. He passed away right before the Broadway run. Right. And I mean, yeah. So you're sort of saying goodbye to the show is saying goodbye to him in a way again.
Yeah. And at the same time, like, it's all very cool. Like, it's like maybe making this space will make space for something else more exciting and interesting, or maybe not, but also like, what a delight. If just this, Dainu, you know, if just this, it would be enough to have gotten this really nice thing to get to watch it on a big screen last night with my family and my friends in a room, which is what happened after the Tonight Show. And then, you know, getting it out to a much wider audience than we'll have seen it live, you know, in front of the general public. That'll be really, really special after, you know, 6 years of writing and working and tinkering and performing and slowing it all over the country, all over the world. Like, what a joyful thing.
Yeah. I'd love to go back to 6 years ago, you know, before this show. How were you feeling about, you know, comedy, your career, what you wanted to do? You say, you kind of joke in the beginning of the special that you kind of specialized in dumb jokes and were doing something very different before this show. So how were you feeling? Were you looking for this kind of thing? Were you looking for like something to really latch onto?
I never thought that I'd do anything that would be like classified in the world of like important, you know, but I also strongly believe that no one should aim for it. That you should just make really dumb stuff. And if you happen to glimpse something that's tangentially geopolitical in your periphery in a convex mirror or something like that, then good for you, good for there. But my first solo show, Millennial, was ostensibly about something. And my second solo show, Everything Handed to You, was also ostensibly about, you know, my first solo show was about generational coherence. My second one was sort of about how lonely we are generally. And I think maybe that those are both directions I'm sort of interested in revisiting at some point. But like this third show about like assimilation and the parts of ourselves that we obscure to fit in. I don't know that you get to act. I hate the idea of accessing those high-minded concepts in a high-minded way. I've always liked doing things really stupid. I've always liked really stupid approaches. I think that's my favorite. That's like what I love about Mel Brooks and Steve Martin. You know, like they get at really smart stuff in really dumb ways. And so, but like where I was as a comedian a bunch of years ago, look, there's a maturation process that happens over the course of every run that's, you know, a week long or 2 weeks long. The maturation over the course. I wasn't even Jewish 6 years ago, you know. Like I was a devout member of the Nation of Islam. So this is a real departure for me. But yeah, I think looking back 6 years ago, there's a lot of, there's a lot of stuff that I see and some stuff that I miss, but I'm grateful for the sort of like, this will be very Elizabeth Gilbert, but I'm very grateful for the journey. The journey really has been the destination.
So, you know, the catalyst for the show is this white supremacist meeting in Queens that you find yourself at. And you say during the show that one of the questions you get most often is, why did you go to the meeting? And it did make me wonder, was it partly because you hoped it would become material? Were you thinking about that at the time? Like, oh, this will be funny to talk about on stage?
You know, I've given different answers to this over the years because I think my opinion on it has changed. But like, I didn't think it would be material for the stage, but I always feel like I have friends. There are like 10 friends I have in my life where I'm just like, do you know how much like Morgan is going to love this? Do you know how much like Benj or Haley or Chloe or David are going to love this when I tell them about this like stupid, can I curse on this podcast? Stupid shit that I did, you know, like they're going to be like, oh, that's really crazy. Like, so I did it for them first. And then they were all like, that's stand-up comedy. And I was like, really? And I was like, and they were like, yeah, man, it's stand-up comedy. Danny Jollis is another brilliant. He's another comedian. He's really brilliant. Danny was like, wait, what, you're not talking about this on stage yet? And I was like, no. And he's like, you idiot. Like, just go out there. My friend Nick, like, so I did it. Like, I didn't know that it was going to be material, but I definitely knew it was going to be material. You know, like, I was like, I knew it was going to be like fun fodder for like sitting outside at Starbucks being like, you guys, I got to tell you what happened last week. Like as soon as the next morning I called my friend Morgan and told him, and he was laughing in the car. And I was like, this is the good stuff. So like, I was never the funny guy who made my friends laugh, and I'm still not. All my friends are funnier than I am. I think I live my life to make my friends like chuckle.
Once you realized that it could be something that you talked about on stage, what was your way in? What was the first joke that you wrote about it or first thought that you had about how to make it funny?
Oh, God, that's such a good question. I could probably go back and look at some point. I think my way in was, there's a line in the show that I think sums up the show, which is I'm sitting there and someone goes, Jews are sneaky and they're everywhere.
Because running through this meeting is this thick vein of anti-Semitism, but I've never seen this kind of anti-Semitism before. It's almost exhilarating. It's like thick, technicolor, weapons-grade, conspiracy theory level anti. Like at some point, this guy two seats away from me, he just went, Jews are sneaky and they're everywhere. And I was like...
We were talking at the beginning about the surreal moments just from this past week. I think there were a lot of them along the way, and I'm always kind of fascinated by the experience of meeting your heroes. I think you were grew up a comedy nerd like me, idolizing some of the people who have now come to see your show and that you've gotten to interact with. I know you've talked a lot about this already, sort of the advice that you sought out from these people. But what was I'm curious about how you sort of handle taking advice from these people who you consider heroes or who you kind of never imagined that you would be in the position to be talking with them in this way. You know, obviously Seinfeld is one of them, Steve Martin. I'm very curious about the specific joke that Steve Martin gave you that you keep referencing in all of your other interviews.
It's very contextual, but Steve Martin recommended a callback early on. And the callback happened late, and I wasn't sure about using the callback earlier. Then I tried a version of it that wasn't quite right. And then Mike Birbiglia sort of kicked the tire in the right way and into the right direction. He said, I say something early on and then it comes back in a big way at the end. And Steve said, you should say, and I said, blank, you should use that callback earlier on. And I wasn't sure, but now it's one of the, but then Birbiglia said, you should say, and I thought of saying blank, which is a nice middle ground, right? It doesn't entirely spoil the thing at the end. And it's one of the biggest laughs in the show. But the right way to take that advice, the right way to take advice from these guys, you got to let your ego go out the window before you even ask, right? Like you're talking to people who know the art, know the craft so much more than you. You're talking to people who are dedicated to the medium above all else for the most part. Although I will say that Billy Crystal has continuously checked on me in a way that is nothing short of very kind. And so I think... if you're going to try to get advice from someone professionally in a teaching moment, you need to sort of align yourself with where you want them to be and where I want those guys to be when they give me advice is someone who's like concerned with the craft, a concern that the craft is being practiced in the right way. And you benefit hugely from it, but it can be a bit ego bruising. So
coming up, Alex gives us a little peek into his thought process around his next solo show. After tackling anti-Semitism and assimilation, he could have moved towards something a bit lighter. Instead, he wants to write and perform an hour on the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to the two episodes we have recorded with Alex Edelman's producer and comedy mentor Mike Birbiglia, as well as a recent episode with Jacqueline Novak, who brought her own 90-minute solo show to Netflix earlier this year, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Wednesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Alex Edelman. So when I saw the show, I saw you at Berkeley Rep, and you made a nod to Israel-Palestine that is not in the special. I mean, I wasn't sure if it was something you had added after. I think the quote that I have here is, I could lose half of you with one line about Israel right now and the other half with two. Why is that not in the special, and when did that sort of idea, you know, come into the show?
I mean, it's not in the special because there was a possibility of putting it in. I thought it was not. I mean, I stand by the line, because the show is about, in some ways, how so much in our lives don't fit into binaries, right? And how our discourse is not rewarding of things that are, you know, not binary, but also. I mean, I went back and forth on this hugely. I think a show should be conversant with a moment, but also an escape from it, a live experience. In a recorded experience, like this special, like I'm a bit of an optimist, actually. I think that this conflict out of this chaos and this the terrible price that has been paid in service in this insane destructive cycle of violence, I think it will eventually become too much for the universe to bear. And I think that, like, at some point, we'll figure out a way to, like, I actually believe in my lifetime there will be, like, a solution to this that doesn't revolve around, you know, one side completely killing the other or that other side completely, like, I don't believe that will have like an entirely bloody end to this. I think that human ingenuity will prevail at some point. And so I don't want something like temporal that fixes this in a hopeless moment, that fixes this permanently in this moment. Because this moment is hard to see the optimism on. It's hard to see the optimism on the other side of this.
I'm curious, though, you know, how the experience of doing the show did change for you after October 7th, because I feel like being publicly Jewish changed after October 7th and sort of the way that the Jews were being perceived. And even though the show is not about that, it is about anti-Semitism and is about these issues. So how did it change for you performing it?
Well, Matt, I'm not Jewish. It's just for the material.
It's just a character,
right? Just a conceit in the show. My real name is Lou Alcindor, and that's it. I honestly thought after when October 7th happened, I called Jenny Gerson, one of our Broadway producers, and I went, should I just cancel the rest of the shows? Like, who can dance in a slaughterhouse, right? Who can clown in this, you know? Because obviously after, you know, there's a huge psychic weight of what's happening in Gaza, what's ongoing in Gaza, what's happening in Israel, everyone feels absolutely berserk with like grief and pain. And I thought, is this really the right way to go about this? But Jenny called me a few days later and was like, you definitely should do the show. Don't be canceling. Like, do a few shows in San Francisco, see how it feels. So things, by the way, have calmed down for me in terms of it almost feels like it's back to by the end of the run. Actually, that's not true. There was a new thing. There was a new environment that I guess I just started to adjust to a little bit. There was a more of a latent tension. There was more of a... but on the other side of that, there's also much more catharsis. People feel much more people feel much closer to the show in a way. And again, I think the show should be conversant with the moment, but also an escape from it if need be. And so it was nice to be doing that. And there are some allusions in the live show to a sort of very complicated set of feelings around Israel and Palestine whenever I engage with it obliquely, because I'm hoping that it will be my next work.
Yeah, I know you've talked about doing a show that really focuses on that issue. I think it's a huge challenge that not many people have taken on. You know, I think I don't know if you've seen Rami Youssef's new special. He talks about it a bit. It's something that you've been talking about for a while. I also just saw Jenna Friedman working out some material about Israel-Palestine. I hope it's okay to share that here. And it led to some very tense moments in the audience, which I imagine is something that you might face if you really go down that path. So how are you feeling about what it would be like to really pursue that right now?
You know, I've always thought that it's interesting because my dedication is to entertainment. And so I've always pitched my work towards that. I've always pitched my work towards entertaining. And so I think for me, the craft challenge of doing that about something like Israel and Palestine, like I would want attention, but I want attention that's focused on the narrative. Like in the same way that like I saw The Ally, the Itamar Moses play. And there's a really good tension that's focused on the narrative, right? The audience is intense because something serious that they feel very strongly about or they feel very strongly against has been evoked. They're feeling for the characters, experiencing a thing that they can relate to. And so that to me is the craft challenge. That to me is the hard work. So hopefully I can do that. But yeah, it's really complicated. It's really not easy. And also it's going to take a long time. Like my work takes forever. Like this show took years to get right, to get together, you know, my first show before.
Is it something that you've started talking about on stage? Cause I know you've been doing some, you know, spots, places and have some shows coming up.
You know, I've got some shows in Providence and some shows in Bloomington, Indiana, and I've got a show at Netflix as a joke. And I've got a few bits that will probably, you know, like go in and out, a few bits that feel relevant to it, a few bits that feel like I'm trying to sort of figure out a way in. But, you know, the big thing is you need to get your arms around there's a unique craft challenge to this. So, yes, I started like poking around at it, but sometimes I go, well, that's too reflective of an emotion I don't feel, or that's too reflective of a truth that is true about this granular point but doesn't take into account the other side. And so, like, you're dealing with it facet-wise with things that you've never really dealt with before. So I started to, like, think about it, but, you know, I only have, like, 4 or 5 bits, and, shows take... I've actually done a lot of jokes about it in the past on BBC Radio and, you know, my various other stand-up sets, other 2 solo shows have allusions to it. But yeah, it's going to be tricky. I'm kind of intrigued by it. But Jenna and Rami are both brilliant, 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 brilliant comedians I'm really tight with and have a lot of love for. And Rami has been texting me nice things about the special, and I texted him some nice stuff about SNL. I'm friends with lots of comedians who I don't necessarily have the same opinions with and opinions on. And Rami and I, like, I'd say we're like pretty good friends. He's like a peer going way back, and I respect him and adore him hugely.
Yeah. Well, I'll be fascinated to see how that material develops. But before we go, I want to do our segment called The First Laugh. Things have gotten a little dark, so maybe we'll lighten it up a little bit. Starting with the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up, what comes to mind?
I mean, I hate to say it because you're like, I want to go light, but Bill Cosby's Noah bit was really, really good. that there was that. I've always loved the songs of Tom Lehrer. Tom Lehrer made me laugh, but I think it has to be either The 2,000-Year-Old Man from Mel Brooks or I loved, I just loved SNL growing up. I really did. I loved some of those sketches and Monty Python. Sorry, it would have been Monty Python. I saw a DVD of Monty Python when I was a kid at the library. And so it's either Monty Python or 2,000-Year-Old Man. But those would be amongst the first laughs.
Do you remember the first time that you knew that you were funny, that you could make other people laugh?
Still waiting. I never had that aha moment. I always felt like it was a thing. You know what? I was in rabbinical school in Israel, and there was a comedy club that had opened up in Jerusalem. And I was getting on stage. And for some reason, I was terrible. I was awful. I was like a 19-year-old kid. I sucked. It was just like beyond bad. Like so bad. Like unspeakably bad. Like if a joke was unearthed from back then, I think I would genuinely try to walk into the ocean with stones in my pockets. But for some reason, they let me headline a night because there were like six comedians in Jerusalem, and I invited everyone I'd ever met or passed on the street. And for some reason, the room was like packed, family, friends, all that stuff, strangers. And I did like 45 minutes, and the material was dreadful, and there was lots of crowd work, I imagine, but for some reason, people really, really laughed. And I didn't deserve any of the laughs, but like that was a really amazing early comedy memory for me. So that was really cool. I really enjoyed that.
Do you remember the first joke that you wrote that you felt really good about, that really worked, that you connected with an audience and thought, you know, hey, I might have something here?
Oh, you absolutely know that I do, which is I had a joke about Sunny. It was when you're an open mic comedian and you suck, you have one good joke and that's what keeps you going. And you close every set with it. And before that, you try stuff, but you know you're closing with your strong one. I had a joke about The Godfather, Sonny Corleone, getting gunned down at the toll booth. And I described the scene in graphic detail. And I go, and if that's not the best commercial for Easy Pass I've ever seen, it's not a terrible
joke.
There you
go. Yeah, there you go.
I could probably bring it back, probably try it. But yeah, it was my first joke.
I often ask guests about their late night stand-up debuts. I was rewatching your first Conan appearance, which I was interested to see, includes a joke. You open with a joke that's in Just For Us, which is the Boston, the part of Boston you grew up in.
I'm from Boston. I'm from this really racist part of Boston called Boston. And I'm an Orthodox Jew. Yeah. I've never had bacon. I'm that kind of Jew. I've never tried bacon. I've tried cocaine, but I've never tried bacon. That's the life I've had. My real name isn't Alex Edelman. My real name, get ready, is David Yosef Shimon Ben Elozer Ruvain Halevi, Alex Edelman. I go by Alex, because it's all I can remember. And like, I get a lot of crap for not going by my real name. Like, my family gives me a lot of shit for it. They're like, why don't you go by your real name? Huh? You're not proud of your real name? And I'm like, no. My dad's name is Elazar. He'll be like, why don't you go by your real name? And I'm like, I don't know Elazar because it sounds like we're all in Slytherin. That's why.
What do you remember about that, you know, first time performing stand-up on Conan?
Oh my God. Well, first of all, I think if my bank password was greatest moment of my life and I couldn't get it, they'd be like, guess. That would be one of the guesses because Conan, first of all, JP Buck had worked on the set with me. I wanted to get on late night for a long time. It just wasn't happening. And JP's like, they approved the set. And all my friends had done late night. I hadn't. I was like, Conan brings me out. And I had been like preparing. There's nothing wrong with being like overprepared. I was so ready to do it. And someone said something in the middle that was a little distracting and I kept going, even though the type of comedian I was back then was still someone who would probably be in, you know. And I finished and Conan came like storming over and he put his arm around me and he went, and he said a couple of really, 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 really nice things. And then he's like, come sit on the couch. And they go to sit on the couch, and he went, you know, this used to be a really big deal for comedians to be invited to sit on the couch. And I went, oh, no, it's a big deal for me. And we're just, like, talking. Like, and then his producer, Jeff Ross, comes over and is like, Conan. And Conan's like, sorry, one second. And he looks at the camera. He's like, we have a great show for you tomorrow. We'll be right back. You know, and then he turns back and he keeps talking to me. And Joel McHale, who was my boss on a sitcom a few months earlier, leaned over and he went, where was that fucking comedy when you were writing on the show? He went, if you had showed some of that, maybe we'd still be on TV. And it was just perfect. And he was so nice. And everyone could see how much it meant to me, which was a really special thing. And yeah, it was a really special day. It was a really special moment. My friends, Morgan, who I told you about, Morgan and Hunter Hill were there. And like, we went to eat Italian after. Like, I remember every single vivid moment of that great day. It was a really incredible day. I think it was March of 2018, but gosh, I was so happy and so pleased, and everyone was so kind and so generous with me. And yeah, gosh, I haven't thought about or been asked about that in maybe ever, but a really like halcyon. And we're both from Brookline, Massachusetts. So he was like, I grew up right here. And I was like, oh no, I know the house with the, by the way, my father called me the next day and he went, oh, you were on Dr. O'Brien's son show. And I was like, what? Because my dad's a doctor at the same hospital or in the same complex, and he knows Conan's dad as Dr. O'Brien. So he was like, yeah, yeah, you were in Dr. O'Brien's show. People were talking about it. I was like, it's Conan O'Brien. You know, like, but yeah, Conan and I have a lot in common. So that was really, we're both 9-foot redheads. So that really.
Oh, yeah. I often ask about meeting comedy heroes, which we kind of talked about already, but since I know you've met Mel Brooks, can you give a quick memory about the first time you met Mel Brooks?
Oh my gosh. Well, the first time wasn't much. He was at a dinner and his sort of amanuensis, Kevin Salter, had taken an interest in me. And by the way, I looked around the room and I thought, I'm the only, like, it was a BAFTA dinner honoring Mel Brooks. And my wonderful partner at the time, Catherine Ryan, who's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant comedian, had been invited and I think had secretly advocated for me to be invited because I was nowhere near important enough to be in the room. But I get to meet Mel. And then I was over there doing a run of my second solo show, actually. And it was a really nice, beautiful sort of like little event. But in the times that I've run into Mel afterwards, he's always sort of asks after me. And I was always sort of like a very avuncular figure. And I went to go see a screening of Blazing Saddles. And I took my friend Cord. And Cord loves Mel Brooks. And afterwards we're meeting. And someone had asked Mel during the Q&A why Richard Pryor co-wrote Blazing Saddles with him. And he was like, well, I didn't know anything about being black in the United States. And Richie knew everything. So I went, Richie, why don't you co-write this movie with me? And afterwards, Cord and I were like, Mel, that's very like woke of you. And he was like, what? And I was like, Mel, that's like representation. That's like a really wonderful thing. And he was like, it was just like the right thing to do. And I'd be like, Mel Brooks totally understands all of the like right ways to do, but like doesn't, it's like a different vocabulary for him.
Yeah, he's just would never like, consider himself woke.
Yeah, but I think it's really funny to hear like Mel Brooks. I was like, Mel, that's like very PC of you. It's like extremely, and he's, but also happens to be completely the right thing to do.
He's always accused of being like anti-PC, right? I mean, Blazing Saddles and the way people talk about that movie.
But I think the funny thing is if you watch Blazing Saddles, I'm of the opinion that Blazing Saddles is actually extremely PC in its like deployment of, you know, it requires a really fine-tuned understanding of who the joke is on and who the joke is about because they're not the same thing, right? Like, for the beginning, at the top, when the sort of like dumb white guys who are forcing the minorities on the railroad to sing a song, and they sing a beautiful version of like "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," and the guys are like, "Nah, sing Camptown Liz, sing like this," and they sing a really stupid song in a really dumb way. You get right away who the joke is on. It's like actually a really beautiful. I've always thought it's just the most brilliant movie deployed so gorgeously. And yeah, big fan. Sorry, I've been long-winded.
No, I don't
usually get asked questions like this. So, you know.
Well, our last question that we ask is there a story or memory from your career that makes you laugh now, but was not funny when it happened?
All of them. I mean, like.
The story that is from your show. Yeah.
I was so annoying. Like, I was really annoying. Like when I was a kid, I'd just like go to the Comedy Cellar. When I was in college, I'd like go to the Comedy Cellar, try to like watch the comedians for free and like see what was what. And like, even in England, I kind of like buzzed around and like, you know, although I'd hear stories about myself later on and be like, well, that's not true. But like, yeah, it was like a really irritating guy. But like, a story that's funny to me now, gosh. Oh, I was with a much cooler comedian and we're out to dinner and I'm sat next to some rapper. I don't remember who the rapper was, but it was like a really cool young rapper. And I'm still at the point in my life where I'm like, God, I really hope that like we don't all split everything evenly here. And I said to the rapper, I said, hey, I heard that song. And I said, whatever song it was. And he was so not interested. I started to just sort of like dig a little. I sort of tried to be annoying. He was like, I was like, I like that song. And he's like, thanks. And I was like, I heard it on Sirius XM University, which is like the college radio station. He's like, okay. And I was like, do you ever listen to Sirius XM University? He was like, I don't think so. And I was like, you know, if you rent a car from Hertz, you get Sirius XM for free. So I don't subscribe to Sirius XM. But I do, sometimes when I rent a car, I always listen to that specific station. And he was like, okay. And I was like, where do you rent from when you rent a car? And I'm just like, everyone's watching just like horrified as I like dig myself deeper with this guy who I think was like, maybe it was Travis Scott or something like that. But it was like a really mortifying. At the time, I thought it was funny. And then I looked around and realized that I'm like, oh, I'm being an idiot. I'm like being really annoying.
No one else thinks this is funny but me.
No one else thinks this is funny but me. And maybe Morgan in, you know, 2 hours. But that's my life. I would do annoying things and then call my friends and be like, isn't this great? Anyone who wasn't my friend would be like, that guy's really irritating. That guy's like, my career started in the UK, like showed up in the UK to do solo shows and slept on people's floors and on their couches. And I think everyone was like, what is going on with this guy? But like early on in my career, I had a lot of those moments.
Well, being annoying at a neo-Nazi meeting ended up paying off. So congratulations.
I guess so, although I'm sure there are a few people who are like, oh God, those guys had to spend an hour and a half with Alex Edelman. What feel pretty bad. What crime, what thought crime could possibly merit that? You know?
Well, I am, as a fellow Boston area Jew, I'm very excited for you and congrats. Yeah, very exciting.
Thanks,
to see the special coming out and that so many people are going to get to see it. And
thank you. That's so sweet.
It's a very important show. And very funny.
Thank you, man. Truly. Really, really nice. This is such a blast, this interview. And if you've listened all the way through, you're a comedy nerd just like me.
Yeah, just like us.
Yeah, just like us.
Just for us. Just for us. Okay. Okay. Thank you so much to Alex Edelman for being my guest on this week's show. His truly exceptional special, Just For Us, is streaming now on Max. So please check it out if you haven't already. You can also get tickets to see Alex work out new material as part of the Netflix is a Joke Festival in LA on May 11th at alexedelmancomedy.com. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Threads at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram and Threads, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.